Welcome to the second season of the Make the Future podcast. I'm your host, Jacques Beauvais, Dean of the Faculty of Engineering at the University of Ottawa. Join us as we have conversations with different thought leaders about current issues facing the engineering industry. Let's explore the future of technology and innovation and how, through creativity and collaboration, we can make the future.
They say the future is coming, but that's not true. The future is already here. And it's relentless. It's not going to wait for you to catch up. How will we live in this future? How will we make sense of it? To define our course, we need a new perspective. One that engages our curiosity, that activates our imagination, one that defies the conventional. To own the future, we need to do more than just see it. We need to make it.
Today, I'm joined again by our guest host, Jamie Petten, who's the president and executive director of the Canada North Business Association. Our two guests today are Amy McLeod, Vice President, Corporate Affairs and External Communications at C-SPAN ULC, as well as Leo Lax, Executive Managing Director at ELSPARC. We're going to talk about the Canada North Technology Park's history and how it became not only a successful technology hub, but the biggest technology park in Canada.
So I'm Amy McLeod. Until very recently, I had been working in and around the park for the last two decades. And I was delighted to serve as chair, of course, of the Canada North Business Association for a couple of years and be on the board there. So my journey and my career has been shaped and really rooted here in Canada North, in the tech space and also in the defense space.
Yeah, so I'm Leo Lax, and I'm now running the accelerator at ELSPARC, which is helping early stage companies. And my background, I started here actually as a staff officer, captain in the Canadian Army, working at CRC as one of the researchers, and then started the company. And I've been really working in this space ever since, from the early 80s, with Terry Matthews in Mitel, and eventually at Newbridge, and so on. So I saw the very beginning of what is now called the Tech Center here, which of course started with Terry and Mike Copeland, who left one of the anchor tenants of the Kanata area called BNR, Bell Northern Research, and started a small company at the time called Mitel. And as the Mitel grew, became successful.
So what year is that, that Mitel started?
72.
Okay.
And so Mitel started in 72. It became kind of really successful around 78 timeframe. Went public, became very successful. And part of that success created a capability to build what now is called the Canada North area. And really to build an area, a cluster such as this requires basically three, if you will, major anchor tenants.
Okay.
You need a anchor tenant in a tech area, and here it was BNR and the government research facilities, which are now called CRC. You needed a ready set of very smart people, students and so on, and the universities in the area were bringing that forward, and we needed a mechanism by which you could build these capabilities, which was a ready market who would be interested in buying these products, and a financial capability to build these companies, which at that time was very, very ready because tech was super hot. It was, everything was tech, and there was a lot of money flowing into building the tech community. Simultaneously to that, and maybe different from what we're talking here today, Terran, who was an architect and a city builder, created an environment, he called it a village, that was built on the assumption that in order to live well, you need a strong balance between workspace, living space, and the world. And he built Kanada using a lot of the green space of ideas that we all know here. When you have that, you end up in a situation that people want to come, people want to work, people want to live here. And I think that really created the initial impetus for building what's today Kanada North.
So you told us, Amy, that you worked in the area for a couple of decades. Have you seen it change, or has it just gotten more like itself in the sense, that sense of community? Was it there a couple of decades ago?
Yeah, I would say that the community was definitely here. I think what's happened is the magnitude of the work that's being done here has grown exponentially. And along with it, the community. We had some anchor, premier companies at the time, Mitel among them, Newbridge, which was acquired later by Alcatel and then merged with Alcatel-Lucent. Ericsson joined the party not too long after. So we've got these great anchor multinationals. What's changed is this incredible startup community that has infiltrated in and around it, that is driving the next generation of development and technology. And I think that's one of the key aspects of a successful technology hub, is those core anchor tenants that are large and multinational and national in nature, and the feeder systems, the incubators that grow around it, LSPARC among them, that is driving that next generation of technology, because we know tech changes quickly.
Yeah.
And so we need to keep pace. And so it's that ecosystem and the rhythm of that ecosystem that keeps organizations and communities like this ever fresh and completely relevant. And that's the secret sauce out here in Kanata North, is the balance between large multinationals, growing startups, and brand new fresh incubator ideas coming out of places like LSPARC.
Leo, you, in your history with Mitel and then subsequently Newbridge, you were influential in setting the precedent for that feeder system through the Newbridge affiliate program.
Correct.
Can you speak to that? Because that's a very early example that now many of our companies build their corporate development activities off of.
And I think it's a unique environment for the way tech evolves. One of the challenges with tech companies, the successful ones grow much faster than the people who are running them. So to give you the best example, at Newbridge, in year four, Newbridge was selling product at maybe $100,000 to $500,000 per customer. In year six, maybe year seven, that same company was addressing and selling products in $1 million to $2 million per customer, and a year later, $20 to $30 million per customer. Now that sales guy is still there. He has come in and he's been a very successful salesperson selling $100,000 things. He's now talking to the people who are buying million and $10 million things, and the skill set does not grow that rapidly. And so that is why we created, originally at Newbridge, the affiliate program. It allowed us to bring in both senior execs who knew how to sell those larger capabilities by building an advisory group around Mitel, who were those senior execs and were opening the doors and addressing the relevant needs of these larger players who were bleeding edge buyers and require not only what normally was being sold by everybody else, but also the bleeding edge. So the combination was a successful way of growing and addressing the market. From a business point of view, we had a capability to allow the footprint of these very large companies who are global in nature to leverage and be leveraged by these very enthusiastic, energetic entrepreneurs
who are risk takers,
who
also
are risk takers and are willing to go the mile, you know, kind of jump over tall bridges and tall buildings in one step to make something happen. And now we're able to address this very interesting segment of the market that the footprint of the larger companies allowed. And that really was the foundation of what I would call similar things that we do now. Every incubator today has that idea of leveraging early stage companies that are connected to global footprint companies and so on. And that's part of the growth. And I think we here in Kanata North are extremely lucky because we have exactly those two solitudes, if you will.
Okay.
Large corporate companies that are global in nature, address the market all around the world, and early stage companies that are building bleeding edge technology, next generation stuff, that when they connect, and it's tough sometimes to connect, mm-hmm. but when they connect, they actually can leverage themselves into a global environment.
I think what drives Kanata North and the success here is not the technology, but it's the talent that builds the technology.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's the piece that we haven't had. And I do think that Kanata North is still on a growth journey, right? Mm-hmm. We're not at the end state yet. We are still building and growing and developing and maturing as a technology park. The arrival of the University of Ottawa and the research capabilities that you bring with it and the next-gen talent that is available through your engineering and other programs, that's the piece that we haven't had. And when we look around successful technology hubs globally, mm-hmm. there's always a core academic part mm-hmm. of it. And so this has been a big year, I think Jamie would agree,
yeah.
With the arrival of University of Ottawa out here in Kanata North to help finish that puzzle for us
yeah.
and make sure that we are set up for that next generation of evolution of the park. Because I don't think we're done yet.
No.
I hope not anyway.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit different origin story because many successful technology park, those first startups, those first companies were coming out of the university that was next door.
Right.
I mean, Stanford was like that. It was built on Stanford land for some of their people who were wanting to go entrepreneurs. So this is a little bit different because the core people who started building it over the years were the industrial people.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And it gives
us... But they were actually leveraging significantly the academic environment,
okay.
both from an IP point of view,
okay.
but they were not as coupled as they were in the States, for sure, and that has created some anomalies
yeah.
in how the academic environment was interfacing into the industrial environment, and that's part of it. But certainly, I'm almost positive if I would say that the first 100 employees of Mitel were early graduates, mm-hmm. if not first graduates, from the universities in Ottawa,
yeah.
Kingston,
yeah.
and the area.
Right.
So they were not. They were the. They were
yeah.
the same.
The closeness, mm-hmm. the physical closeness was maybe not there, but the spiritual closeness was there.
Was necessary because
yeah.
you needed that level of enthusiasm and willingness to take on whatever challenge is being provided and converted into something that generates some opportunity.
How about the in those days when it was not as smooth sailing
yeah,
as
I
it was
I used to call
before?
It the nuclear winter.
The nuclear winter, okay. So during that period, was the sense of community there, or were people scrambling to try to survive, or was
yeah.
there... Because you talk about the importance of I'm not sure it's the right word, but you describe something which is sort of the scaling up of the people in the company, and,
yes.
and you can't keep the same people as the company starts to grow. There must have been a lot of need to, people must have been moving around, I guess, or not really?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because people want, so I'll give you the best example.
Uh-huh.
Nortel went bust. Companies that Amy just described didn't just happen to be here. They are here because they purchased a portion of Nortel.
Mm-hmm.
Ericsson purchased a portion of Nortel. Ciena purchased a portion of Nortel. Ribbon brought a portion. These are all companies that are new to the area, but the people working on it
mm-hmm.
have been working in the area for the past 10 or 20 years, and as the companies brought in new global perspectives, they became the Ciena's, the Ericsson's, the Nokia's, and so on, they brought with them other people from their community to
okay.
come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say one of the interesting things that has happened is that we were able to emerge, if you will, from that nuclear winter, if you will, while the people that here remained residents of the Kanata area, of the Ottawa area. They continued, obviously some have left, many
mm-hmm.
have left, but
yeah.
a large majority stayed here. And that meant their families stayed here. That meant that their children were grown up here. Many of them decided this is a great place I grew up. I want to continue being here and working here and so on. And therefore, they joined some of the existing companies, or if they were entrepreneurially bent, where would they go build their new companies? Right here, where they actually grew up and so on. And that was part of that engine, I think, that continued to help us grow. Now, I think also from a technology point of view, the world was transforming.
Mm-hmm.
The traditional hardware-oriented environment was transforming everywhere in the world. And I think it is a testimony to our environment here that we are able to transform, mm-hmm. and the people are transforming, and the companies that we see emerging in the era are now software-driven mm-hmm. companies that have emerged or have been able to transform their world from what they traditionally did in the past mm-hmm. and grew up to be something else. Of course, those that did not are no longer here.
Mm-hmm. But as you were saying that you arrived here just before, to use Leo's expression, the nuclear winter, did you ever have the sense that people had lost confidence, or were they in a mood that we're going to get through this and we're going to rebuild?
Oh, no. I mean, it was they were not easy days. I don't think there was any rose-colored glasses. I mean, people have realities of they have to work for a living, right? So there was a reality to what was happening, and it did shrink.
Yeah.
I mean, the numbers will tell you the case there. But what was interesting from my perspective is all of those multinationals that did. I mean, so two things happened, right? When the market contracts, you become a bit of a hunting ground for multinationals who are looking for good value and high talent and mm-hmm. good products and market share. And so we became an attractive community from the perspective of foreign investment. And I think, quite honestly, there were many of us, myself among them, who were worried about that at the time, that we were being hollowed out in some horrible way, that we were going to lose something. And I think if I look back now with maybe 20 years experience, it might have been the best thing that ever happened to Kanata North, because that influx of investment kept things going through that period where it was really, really challenging. The second dynamic of that period, as I recall, was that some folks actually left the multinationals and went to the startups. I mean, Tropic Networks sort of flamed up in a major and impressive way at the time. Solace, all these little startups, people who were in the multinationals said that maybe that's not for me. They took their equity that was built over the good days, and they took it into the startup. So they didn't leave town. They fed that next generation. That's the virtuous cycle, right? That mm-hmm. is when you get scale. That is when you get something really, really special. So I think in hindsight, the nuclear winter might have been a good thing for us. It really did mature us in an interesting way and kept us here.
And we are in a very competitive market. So Kanata North is competing with the many other tech centers in the world. And it's not good enough to rely on our history or on mm-hmm. our traditions or the fact that we have some key players here who are now, we actually need to be able to leverage that and be able to continue that growth by building a capability, a visibility, being able to recognize the qualities that we can provide here, and allowing the early stage entrepreneurs to recognize that it's much easier to build a market leader coming from this environment, which has rich history, knowledgeable individuals, as well as a reach to the market, than trying it in some other locations which are much more competitive in other techs. However, tech centers, I mean. However, we, I would say, are not as proactive yet. Kanata North has taken a leadership. U of O, by being here, has taken a leadership and saying, we like what this is, and we are going to make it again mm-hmm. as strong and as vibrant as it was once, because we can. And we are emerging from that nuclear winter
mm-hmm.
much more capable of doing that. There are very few places where we can have 25 global companies mm-hmm. within 5 kilometers of each other.
Okay, speaking of being aggressive enough, I mean, Montreal and Toronto are being very aggressive around the artificial intelligence sector.
Very much so.
how are we doing with respect to that kind of approach? They're bringing in big companies into the area. Are we ahead of the curve in the sense that the passion for just the algorithms of developing the fundamentals of AI, that's not going to last forever, and we're going to need to turn to applications and companies with real products
trying to sell. I think what you just said is exactly the situation. I think I would say Ottawa is an applications company.
Mm.
We are not an AI company.
Yeah.
We are not an AI environment. We are an application environment. We deliver products to the market. We use AI in order to get better products to the market, and they'll deliver better value to the customers, et cetera. And therefore, I see this as a very complementary process. And instead of, I would say, looking at it and saying, I would like to create a center of excellence for AI, I think we need to create a center of excellence for things that we are delivering into the market,
mm-hmm.
which is applications, value-add capabilities that are actually serving directly the individuals who are using our products every day, whether they are software-oriented products, hardware-oriented product, combination of the two. These are now very, very undefined boundaries. There is a gray area that is unknown, you know, and you could call everything that is hardware eventually software, and everything that's software eventually becomes hardware, and all of these things transition back and forth. We have, amazingly enough, actually the foundation to do both right here. And I think that is, from a technical point of view, great. And I wouldn't be ashamed to say that we are not in building AI companies.
Mm-hmm.
We are here to build companies that use AI
mm-hmm.
to make the world better.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like sometimes as Canadians, it's our natural DNA to look in the rearview mirror and say, oh, we're not doing this or that, and they did it faster or quicker. I don't think we have anything to apologize for, and I don't think we're laggards in any way. I think that what we have here is a capability that is unique to Canada North, and I agree with you, Leo. It is now taking us down that applications road. If we talk, we talked about QNX, we talk about autonomous vehicles, we talk mm-hmm. about these applications that we are all that are integrated to our life and our work in every single way. I feel like we have to be who we are and mm-hmm. not try to be who our neighbors are. And that's always been the key to success here. There was no telecommunications industry here until somebody with an expertise and an interest developed it.
Mm-hmm.
There was no capability on autonomous vehicles until our friends up the road say, hey, we know how to work inside of a car. Let's build an application that maybe one day can drive one.
The capabilities here that we have are addressing directly end user opportunities or companies that are serving end user opportunities. We must not lose sight of that.
Mm-hmm.
From a IP point of view, building new informatics capabilities here, it's even more interesting because one of those things that we know how to do or we have had experience to do because of our history is work into very large global entities. It's very easy to talk about how to apply AI in Canada. It is much more difficult to figure out what AI means in a global context. And we can talk about all of the side issues associated with that. I think our companies, because they are users of the tool set, are starting to grapple with these information, and they're actually delivering a value back into the economy and saying, when I do my AI stuff, I make sure that it is ethical, I make sure that it is bias-free, I have means by which I can explain how I got to those particular decisions from an AI perspective, because actually I'm not all about the algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all about how to make the world better.
Mm-hmm. But we must have certain things we still need to improve.
Absolutely. There is gaps, for sure.
What do you see as perhaps some of those gaps?
Talent. Is where you come in,
yeah.
Which is where we need the University of Ottawa and others to kind of join us in the park.
Yeah.
It is what fuels and feeds us, right? And it is a highly competitive
mm-hmm.
talent landscape. Your folks, your students are in high demand.
They are.
And they are the innovation at the end of the day. It's not the businesses that innovate, it's the people
yeah.
in the businesses. And I feel like that is... And it's in every sector, and I would mm-hmm. offer maybe even in every geography right now. The hunt for talent is real. And whoever wins it will win the next sort of round mm-hmm. in that virtuous cycle. Where does the talent go? Because where the talent goes, the innovation follows.
Yeah.
What's interesting in a process that we're looking at is, I'll say the word innovation. So innovation is actually a bad word for a steady state, steady she grows public company. Because innovation is changing things. It's mm-hmm. it's creating something that was not there. It's taking risks that are not part of what the day-to-day environment of a large corporate entity is interested in. In fact, innovation is an irritant. Yet we need to create, I would say, a comfort, soft landing process for the community that is all about innovation, which are the universities and the students that are learning how to innovate, are learning how to build the next, think about it, figure out what their mindset need to be in order to address these needs, and we need to create that capability. Our universities are the first step in that protective environment to say, go for it, anything goes. You can go and try to build whatever you'd like because you're safe here and you can do it. We also need a means by which, hopefully, the universities can reach out, as you have done here, to the industrial community and say, no, I don't want you to buy my people or pay for my research or any of those things. I want you to work with me to build an environment where our risk takers, I'll call them that, in the academic world can work safely to deliver innovation before you decide to kill them mm-hmm. because your system says change is terrible, steady she goes, I made my quarter, I'm going to make my next quarter process. And I think a place like this is one of the first steps. You are now starting to get credibility with the industry partners here to say, yes, we want to partner with you, and we want to partner with you by creating the transitional process to allow your professors, if I could say that, mm-hmm. who are innovating and thinking deep thoughts, the students who are working with them to implement them and find, test them and so on, to actually be able to share and exchange information and start injecting, if you will, that innovation in a smoother fashion, in a more protected environment, so that they can grow, mm-hmm. become mature enough that they can stand on their own two feet when they actually become commercial opportunities.
One of the things that we need in academia also is to find out what the real problems are.
You disagree.
You disagree?
Yes.
Why?
Because I know what those real problems are and I'm going to solve them. And I got people and money to do so. And if I don't, somebody's going to shoot me
okay.
as a company. But I don't have the expertise or even the ability to have you think laterally on something that doesn't make sense.
Okay.
So that is, I think, the place where we need. So for you to give me the ability to solve my today's problem,
mm-hmm.
I'll be certainly very appreciative, and the innovation in that space is going to let me go and incrementally grow my business from 15% a year to 25% growth a year, and that's amazing, and I'll be the hero. But if I want to be part of whatever is called the whatever next,
mm-hmm.
I think the university organization has to be given an opportunity to choose their own path. I recognize there is a risk in mm-hmm. choosing your own path because you commit.
Yeah.
You know, and if you commit to go to the wrong place, well, you end up in the wrong place. However, that's a more protected environment.
Yeah, it's a place where you can take that
and
risk.
And I encourage both the students and the profs to do that leap. But, and I must say that because I kind of, that's my pet peeve. If that's all we do, then all of this amazing energy and amazing new ideas die.
Mm-hmm.
We still need to create that intermediate protective environment that allows that crazy idea that made absolutely no sense to even think about it come to fruition well enough to become attractive for a commercial entity to actually say, I now want to take hold of it and put it and make it available to the market. I'll give you an anecdote only because many, many years ago, in the 80s, I was in Japan, and I was working with a laboratory in Sony. So Sony, videos, audio, Walkman, during my time, I get it. The guy who was leading that laboratory told me that his objective was to be, this is 1980s, to deliver movies to everybody in their home wirelessly. There was no sensors, there was no cameras, there was no iPods, there was no iPhones, nothing. What he was talking about made absolutely zero sense. But he was given the opportunity to play. At that time, as part of a, I was an early stage company at the time here in Ottawa. What I need, I would have told him exactly what I need, but that was what I need in the next 3 to 5 years.
But is there not, if we're going to be training students to be the talent that's going to be recruited, do you not need a certain number of them to be working closely with people in industry and all that? Because doesn't it accelerate a little bit their transfer?
I think yes, but I would say that there's another huge value to add. With the presence of the university here, and that is to address the a couple of ways that I think that the university should be thinking. I think the long academic process that you are used to, you know, this is a rapid-paced innovation environment, and so you kind of got to get your head on that way. And so if I'm not an academic or an engineer, so apologies up front, but I see opportunity in two ways for organizations like the University of Ottawa to really add value to the park and to your students. Think like Leo's LSpark startups. Think like an accelerator that has a great idea and it needs to pitch it. Teach your students to think that way and then pitch it. Like take it right to the full end. Get them thinking about brand new white space in the market and how they can do something that nobody else is doing in the park or elsewhere. And then pitch it to the relevant companies here. Because you might be doing R&D or creating a product line that they haven't thought of yet. So it's a little bit more pragmatic than I think we're used to asking our esteemed universities and all of the research capacity and capability you have, is to think agilely and rapid development to address a market need. Not a company need necessarily, but a market need.
Yeah.
I think that's a little bit different. And then the other piece would be to, you know, think about with the large multinationals that Leo talked about, who don't, you know, innovation is like, oh, I don't know, it's gonna disrupt my whole world. But they have to do it or they'll be irrelevant. How can you do outsourced research, agile, fresh development for those who are those big, you know, successful but perhaps slower moving? I feel like that's where the value of the university can, that you can carve out a space for yourself and your students and add value to the park and to the businesses here, and maybe even launch your own business. I mean, I think that's how engineers think now. I'm not one, but I think they're equal minds, business people and engineers, and that's a pretty core competency to start to get into the student body.
So I'd like to thank both of you, because in a way I think our conversation this afternoon, you've thrown us a challenge at the university, which is good, to try, and what you've described actually is a very different model than what is being put in place in many.
Really?
I think so, because usually the conversation that I've known a couple of technology park with is how can we sort of, the question I had asked you, how do we get to know the real problems that the companies have so that we can align what we're doing in research to try and solve those problems? But there's always a challenge with that because we're not working at the same speed. We're not working at the speed of business. And we can't because we're training master's students, we're training PhD students. You've thrown us a different challenge to say, one, we talked about that safe space where those ideas can be developed, and also to really open up the freedom of developing those ideas and then pitching them to the companies in the technology park to try and bring them from that idea concept all the way to an impact later on. I want to thank you all for tuning in on this episode of the Make the Future podcast. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and that you learned as much as I did. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss the next episode. I would also like to really thank our guests and the podcast production team, Carl Borns, Valérie Sanson, Karen Massé, and Francis Bertrand Lafrenière. And I really hope you can join us next time.